Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting here at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. I hope you all enjoyed some happy haunting over Halloween weekend. Today we open with a story about a judge's ruling that's come as a shocker to Alpine parents in their case against the Grossmont Union High School District regarding the long-sought high school in Alpine. We'll also have details today about a Cedar Fire Memorial that opened last week in Lakeside to commemorate lives lost, survivors, and those brave firefighters who fought to save others during California's worst wildfire ever. Covert Canyon is back in the news. The controversial site in Alpine has obtained tentative approval to provide firearms training for government, the military, and law enforcement, but the decision can be appealed and we'll have details. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is warning California residents to buy flood insurance before the El Niño hits, bringing what could be the wettest winter in ages, along with flooding and mudslides, potentially, that are not covered by your standard homeowner insurance. Plus, the county is offering free sand and bags at 15 local fire stations for residents in the unincorporated areas to stock up and protect your property before those heavy rains come. Also here today, how California has reduced the number of uninsured children dramatically. In fact, more than any other state in the United States. Our newsmaker interview today is with Molly Nocum from Noah's Homes, a remarkable facility providing a nurturing environment for developmentally disabled adults. She'll also be talking about the startling link found by scientists here in San Diego between Down syndrome and Alzheimer's. And it's not hard to figure out why Molly earned the Women in Leadership Award from the San Diego East County Chamber of Commerce recently. The Obama administration has announced reforms in school testing in response to concerns raised by teachers and parents. And here in California, we'll have news about some services for children with severe health problems that have been restored by the state. And finally, on the second half of our show today, we will re-air our Halloween special presentation with readings of some spine-tingling ghost stories from East County's colorful past. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. For Alpine parents, a ruling by Superior Court Judge Joel Pressman last Thursday sounds like a Halloween horror story. But for the board majority at the Grossmont Union High School District, it came as a treat. The judge issued a tentative ruling, granting Grossmont's motion to dismiss a lawsuit filed by Alpine parents and taxpayers. The suit sought to force the district to turn over funds to build an Alpine High School, which voters twice voted to approve in Propositions H and U. The board's action drew scrutiny from the county grand jury, which issued a scathing report titled, "Fool Us Once, Fool Us Twice." The tentative ruling comes as a shock to many, since Judge Pressman previously denied an attempt by Grossmont to dismiss the case and set a trial date for early December. In his earlier ruling, the judge rejected Grossmont's arguments that it did not have a contract commitment with Alpine to build a high school and that the text of Prop U did not compel the district to build the long-promised school. But in Thursday's tentative ruling, the same judge inexplicably reversed himself, now stating there does not appear to be a contract to build the new high school. He further adds that neither Prop U nor Prop H obligated construction of the Alpine High School. The court heard final oral arguments Friday, and Judge Pressman will subsequently issue a final ruling. An email sent by Jeanette Liljestrom, executive assistant and clerk to the district's governing board, states if the court affirms the tentative ruling, we will have prevailed in our request to have the lawsuit dismissed. Trustee Priscilla Schreiber, who has consistently supported Alpine parents and opposed the action of the Grossmont Union High School Board majority, called the tentative ruling incredibly sad and wrong. Schreiber voiced hope that the judge would reconsider, adding, "It's just so surreal that he would find fault in his own argument in justifying the injunction." Ultimately, the case is likely to be decided by a higher court on appeal, so until then, the fate of money that the court ordered set aside to build the high school in Alpine remains in limbo. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
An overflow crowd was on hand to witness the dedication ceremony for the newly completed Cedar Fire Historic Monument on Saturday, October 14th. The monument includes a pocket park and honors first responders, those lost in the fire, as well as the strength and resilience of the survivors. In attendance were Supervisor Diane Jacob, Fire Chief Andy Parr, along with the Lakeside Fire District's Board of Directors, the Cedar Fire Monument Committee, contractors, donors, and sponsors who dedicated time, equipment, supplies, and labor to build this park. The Cedar Fire burned 280,278 acres and destroyed 2,232 homes and killed 15 people, including one firefighter, before being contained on November 3, 2003. It still ranks as the largest and deadliest wildfire in California history. This monument has been designed as a place to inspire people to reflect, reconnect, and remember Lakeside's struggle and rebirth after the Cedar Fire. County Supervisor Diane Jacobs spoke eloquently of the Cedar Fire as the moment in time when everything changed in East County. Everything changed the moment the fire went into the city of San Diego. City dwellers began to realize that what happens in East County affects the rest of the region. She went on to say, since then, $320 million have gone into fire prevention and protection. Just then, the sound of sirens and fire trucks leaving the stations interrupted her speech. Then she continued, we have learned lessons. We have come together. We have improved our preparedness, our awareness, and shortened our response time. She concluded with, this living memorial is a place to reflect, take stock, and never forget. Fire Chief Andy Parr told East County Magazine, this place will mean different things to different visitors. Firefighters will come to remember and honor their fallen brother. To victims of the fire who lost their homes, lost everything, and more, this will be a special place. However, people who are new to Lakeside or never heard of the Cedar Fire will visit the Garden Park. Elementary school children studying California history will visit this site. We wanted this to be a place of learning, lessons learned, and positive hope for a safer future ahead as we learn to adapt to living in grassland conditions. Chief Parr was quick to point out that although the district donated the land and there was some funding set aside for just such a memorial, it was the community that came together to fund, plan, and build this as a lasting remembrance that is still growing and evolving. The walkway has inscribed the names and dates of past wildfires and on into the future because there will be more fires. The walls will be adorned with art made from remnants of the destruction. Artist Jackie Hansen, with the help of David Teifeld, the community of survivors created four murals made from the remnants of the Cedar Fire. David said, some of these pieces of pottery or glass are all that remained of someone's home. This has been Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
The county's Planning and Development Services Department has issued a stipulated administrative enforcement order allowing the owner of the controversial Covert Canyon site in rural Alpine to conduct military and law enforcement firearms training on an interim basis while pursuing a discretionary permit. The order is a written decision by the department's director that may be appealed if a request is filed within 10 days of the decision date. Any appeal must be received by the department before November 5th at 5 p.m. Covert Canyon's owner has a history of conducting military-type training operations without first obtaining permits and has previously been the target of enforcement actions by the county, including a prior shutdown. Mark Halcon, the property owner, has long contended that his actions were lawful. Activities that raised concerns among some community members in the past included live fire exercises in which pigs were shot to provide training for military paramedics. Fire officials have also raised concerns previously over fire hazards raised by activities at the site. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is urging all Californians to buy flood insurance before the torrential rains forecast due to El Niño conditions strikes. Even those who live in areas at low to moderate risk of flooding should buy flood insurance and do so immediately since there is a 30-day waiting period before policies take effect, FEMA advises. If there was ever a time to buy flood insurance, this is the time, FEMA's Deputy Associate Administrator for Insurance and Mitigation told reporters at a press conference last week. Flood insurance also provides coverage for damage from mudslides, such as those that buried hundreds of cars on Interstate 5 and State Route 58 recently. The average flood claim last year for residential properties was over $39,000, yet flood insurance costs about $700 a year. With possibly the wettest winter in recent memory forecast to begin in a month or so, signing up for flood insurance could be a very wise investment to protect your home. Standard homeowner policies do not cover flooding caused by rainfall, mud flows, or disasters such as hurricanes or tropical storms, so Congress created the National Flood Insurance Program that allows homeowners and business property owners to purchase policies to protect themselves in communities that participate with ordinances that reduce risk of flooding per FEMA requirements. Flood insurance covers damage to buildings, but typically does not cover contents unless you secure optional additional coverage. Just a few inches of water from flooding can cause tens of thousands of dollars in damage or even destroy a residence. You can get information on flood insurance and the flood risk where you live at floodsmart.gov. You should also create an emergency response plan for your household. You can get information on preparations to take at the website ready.gov.
Weather forecasters predict a chance of showers this week as we head into the much-anticipated El Niño season, which could mean a lot more rainfall than we've seen for a long time. The County of San Diego is offering free sand and bags to residents in unincorporated communities, now available at 15 fire stations, more places than ever before. Even more locations are scheduled to be added in the coming weeks. Just bring a shovel and you'll be good to go. Because of the historic drought, increased rains that El Niño is expected to bring could also mean higher risk of flooding and soil erosion, especially in places that are not covered by vegetation. Water runoff, mud, and debris swept downstream by rains can damage homes, clog storm drains, cause flooding, and damage roadways. If your property has slopes, you can use mulch, terrace the slopes, plant ground covers and shrubs to keep hills from eroding. You can get free sand and bags at fire stations in Alpine, Bonita, Boulevard, Deluz, Dulzura, El Cajon, Fallbrook, Julian, Palomar Mountain, Palma Valley, Rincon, Ramona, Valley Center, and Warner Springs. For more information on how to stay safe during flooding, you can check ReadySanDiego.org.
California has dropped the number of uninsured kids by 176,000, more than any other state since the Affordable Care Act went into full effect in 2014. The data come from a new report on the rate of uninsured children in the U.S. by the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. Report co-author Joan Alker says that when California expanded Medicaid for adults, they signed up a lot of kids who were eligible but not yet enrolled.
Many people don't think about Medicaid expansion as a kids issue, but we know from past research that covering parents results in what we call a strong welcome effect for kids. That means when the parent learns about their own coverage opportunity, they also may learn that their child is eligible.
In the U.S. overall, 6% of children don't have health insurance. In California, it's 5.4%. Kristen Golden Testa with the nonprofit advocacy group Children's Partnership says the situation will get even better next year once a groundbreaking new state law to help undocumented children goes into effect.
All low-income children will be able to enroll in Medi-Cal regardless of their immigration status. This will mean an additional 170,000 children will have insurance.
Testa says that because California has the biggest population in the country, gains here will make a big dent in the national rate of uninsured children. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and today we're talking with Molly Nokon, who is Chief Executive Officer of NOAA Homes and the past president. Molly is also the winner of the Women in Leadership Award by the East County Chamber of Commerce. So really honored to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for being here and taking your time, because reading your bio and what you're doing, I can tell you're a very busy person. Tell our listeners what NOAA Homes is.
NOAA Homes is an amazing organization here in East County that used to be a very hidden gem that has now come into the limelight, mostly because we're taking care of adults with disabilities that need a lot of special care because of the aging factors and the development of Alzheimer's in this population. So we are very busy making sure we can keep them in their homes and safe and independent.
Let's talk about your history. You're in Spring Valley, and you started around 1986.
We started with one home. We are right next door to Steel Canyon High School. Everybody wonders why there's an arc down there, and the arc wasn't in the mountains. It was here in East County, so you can find that original arc here. That was an arc from the Mother Goose Parade years ago. But one home with six residents, and we are now eight homes with 70 residents. Our residents are commonly known for us as the folks. The folks always keep us well informed of what's happening in those homes. We're on a beautiful campus, about 8 acres, and then we have three homes in our vicinity within a quarter mile of the campus. So we're a wonderful community campus setting.
And I was noticing that your background is quite interesting, too. You went to San Diego State. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
I did. I took an interesting journey to get to NOAA Homes. I was a telecommunications major, and I had a minor in business administration. And so I spent my career in my own business while I was raising children and did a lot of consulting for small businesses and did accounting or human resources or marketing. Mm-hmm. And so NOAA Homes was the first place I got to come to and put all of my talents into one basket and use almost every one of them every day, it seems like.
And what got you interested specifically with the children or the folks?
The folks at NOAA Homes. Well, I was a family member of a brother with a disability. His name was Herbie, and he was the sheriff of NOAA Homes, fondly named because he had such a love and obsession of anything police or sheriff or FBI. And so he would make sure the doors were locked. And if you didn't have your doors locked, he left you a ticket. So he had quite the reputation over there. He loved safety and loved to make sure everybody was safe. So my brother lived there for 14 years after my parents died rather close to each other. And he wanted to be with his friends, and he wanted to be a place where he could be independent, but be safe. And he needed some oversight and supervision. And NOAA Homes was able to give that to him, and I was very fortunate at the time there was an opening because there was always a waiting list at NOAA Homes.
What's different about NOAA's home?
NOAA Homes was developed on a method called the LaRoche method, and it's a method that was created in France years ago. And it's a method of dealing with people with disabilities as a community. And as much as we like to show independence and give people with disabilities as much independence as possible, we also know they need supports. And so by living on a campus setting, with individual homes on that campus, our residents can very safely and securely visit their friends. They can partner up with other houses and go on outings. They can do things on their own. But they're very safe in a community setting. One of the requirements to live at NOAA is that you have a job in the community so that you're out in the community and being productive every day. So our residents live probably a faster paced and more involved life than most of us do. They're out every day at a job or a self-improvement type of program, day program. And then on the weekends, they're out in the community at Charger games and Padre games and any kind of events going on. And they're also really great volunteers.
That's wonderful. What is the purpose of all this activity? What is the compass?
We want to make sure that anybody with a disability lives the exact same kind of life that you and I do. And to accomplish that, they just need some supports. And many of our residents carry jobs. They pay taxes. They're very strong supporters of the community. And we want to give them that opportunity. And to do that, it takes a setting like a NOAA Homes that provides a fleet of vehicles. It provides 24-hour staffing. And it provides them the safety net that if they need help or something happens to them, somebody is there to make sure they're okay. It's a choice that we want out there for anybody with a disability. Doesn't have to be the only way to live, but community campus living is such a wonderful involvement. And one of the things I've always heard from our residents and others that when you live in a community, they're people like me. They don't judge me for who I am. I'm just me. And when I want to be in my community, I am. And when I want to be in the rest of the community, I can do that too. It's a wonderful way to live in a choice of whatever they want to do.
There are other choices, of course. Is there a great need for this kind of care?
Well, I'm a bit prejudiced in the community campus setting, but just in the needs of people with disabilities, there's a huge need. California is fortunate in that we're an entitlement state. So we take care of anybody with a disability by providing services and funding for their needs. Other states have waiting lists. So I'm very happy to know that California does not have a waiting list. You are just provided services if you need them. However, the services are dwindling because people like Noah Holmes are not paid very well. My hourly reimbursement rate for somebody living it with us is $3 an hour, and those rates were frozen in 2000. So to live in rates that are 15 years old has been difficult. But yes, with the community support and all the fundraising we do, we're making it.
Well, everything's cost twice as much as it did.
It's very expensive. And, but that's why we rely upon the community. That's why we need people to know we're here. We want them to have as great a life as we do. And to do that, we have to keep fundraising, and we have to keep making sure that, they're the focus of what we do in our community.
Well, you must have some great partners in the community to be able to do this.
We have some amazing partners, and I am very grateful for all of them. We are currently getting ready to build, we are building actually two new homes. Both of them will be specifically for adults with disabilities dealing with Alzheimer's. We have partnered with a wonderful organization here in town called HomeAid San Diego. They are a group of building professionals and community partners who have partnered with us to build these two homes at little or no cost. They have been amazing. We have 25 partners, I believe, currently through them. Brookfield Homes is another one who stepped in to help us build these homes at little or no cost. The Hamul Indian Reservation is currently building, and they are sharing their building services with us as well. Richard St. Jean and Erica Pinto have been phenomenal in coming to our rescue and helping us when we need assistance on finding resources. So I can't thank the community enough. It is something that we could never have done by ourselves. And we're literally about a year ahead of schedule in what we thought we would be doing to open these homes. So we're excited.
Where are the two new homes going to be?
Two new homes will be on our campus.
Okay.
So that will complement and fill out our campus. So we'll have a full complement of 8 homes on the campus and 2 more in the community. So we'll be at a total of 10 homes.
Now, can you tell me a little bit more about the connection between Alzheimer's and Down syndrome?
Yes, it was discovered about 4 or 5 years ago through a joint research effort with the National Institute of Health, and the UCSD Down Syndrome Clinic here is one of the leaders in this research. They're collaborating with others across the country that the 21st chromosome that causes a mutation for Down syndrome is also the known plaque collector for Alzheimer's. So what they've now discovered, which is one of the reasons I've been so passionate, my brother was the first to walk through Noah when we really all recognized that he wasn't just dealing with a grumpy personality or just getting crotchety. He was dealing with Alzheimer's. So this research has now proved the fact that anybody with Down syndrome, if they live long enough, will develop Alzheimer's.
Mm.
And when Noah opened 32 years ago, the average age in our campus was 27.
Mm-hmm.
And 32 years later, it's now 48.
Wow.
So these folks are living wonderful, long, happy, and healthy lives. And our eldest right now is 67 and thriving.
Wow.
Our youngest, I believe, is 21, so mm-hmm. we have a pretty good spectrum of that. But we want to make sure that they continue to live in good health, and we want to make sure that we can provide those services for them. It's also very important to us they stay in their homes.
Mm. And so are your folks part of this study with UCSD?
They are. We were very fortunate to partner with UCSD and Dr. Michael Raffi, and he needed some residents that were slightly older. And because we have this campus setting, we have a lot of residents who've been with us 20, 30 years. Of our 6 original residents, 4 are still with us 32 years later.
Wonderful.
So we have a very strong longevity at NOAA, not only of our residents, but of our staff.
What's the future for NOAA's homes? What do you need? Where are you going? And how do we get there?
The future for Noah Homes is extremely bright, and we're very, very excited to not only be building 2 new homes, but to be the first in California. We are the quality of care that we want to see everybody else emulate. So we want to be that pattern that everybody else will emulate. Our goal is to hand the state a template to build these homes across the state. We want to make sure that everybody else has the ability to live with the dignity that our residents live in. And we want them to know that the research and the time we've spent with Dr. Raffi at UCSD and others across the country, frankly, I've been traveling across the country for the last year looking at everything I can find to make sure that our homes are the best and reflective of anything out there that's new and innovative and what our residents need.
And if we want to help, if I wanted to come down and volunteer?
You will be welcome with open arms.
Thank you.
If you go to our website, www.noahhomes.org, you will see volunteer opportunities. We have a wonderful young lady named Brittany who was very happy to hear from you. Her phone number is on the website, as is her email. But you can volunteer with the residents directly. You can volunteer with fundraising, with gardening, with nursery, all sorts of things going on. So imagine trying to be the housekeeper for 8 large homes and 70 children, and you put those into adults that have a lot more needs and a lot more things, and that's who we are. So we need lots of volunteers.
I noticed from your website you have some very accomplished staff.
We do. I am very proud to say that we have some of the biggest longevity of staff. Our managers have a tenure of about 10 years, which is unheard of in our industry. Our care providers in the homes are 3 to 4 years in average turnover, which in this industry, unfortunately, because of the low pay and the reimbursement from the state, it's usually 100% a year in this industry, unfortunately. And we're very fortunate not to have that. And the quality of care it gives our residents is huge because they know who they are and they know what to expect from them.
Yeah. Well, I got to ask you, what do you do to inspire and keep such wonderful help?
I have been very blessed in that I walked into an organization that was very well put together and had passionate people who were there, quote, for the folks. We call our residents the folks because they are our folks and they are the people that we care about and have become part of our family. So many people just aren't able to leave because they've grown attached to this family. But NOAA Homes also tries really, really hard to make sure that we're family-oriented and family-centered. We try hard to make sure that whatever benefits we can give them, we can give them. We are attached to the Diocese of San Diego through the Catholic Diocese, so they give us some benefits that we're able to pass on to our staff. So as much as we can't be the highest payer because of state reimbursements, we have a heart of gold, and we love the fact that people love our residents and put them first. So we do everything we can to be an open and efficient campus. We're very open to ideas and making sure that we're giving our folks everything they can, and what a better place to get them than the folks that are giving them care every day. So our staff are very open and helpful in making sure that we're doing the right things for these people and that we're treating them with all the dignity and the respect that they deserve.
You know, my stepson was in a group home, and I coached Special Olympics for 5 years. And I have to say there's a special reward, I guess you could call it, from working with these folks.
There is. My brother, as much as I was a younger sister and didn't pay a lot of attention to me all the time, he was a wonderful guy, and he had so much to share and so much to give. And we're all trying to figure out why people with disabilities are always so doggone happy. It puts us to shame sometimes. We all come to work in a grumpy mood, and we walk in, and they're there to greet us and give us a hug and let us know what their day is going to be like. And we think, wow, what are we grumpy about? They're amazing people, so I can't complain about that at all. It's a beautiful setting and a wonderful place to be. So I'm very thankful that I somehow managed to land there.
Is there anything that I haven't asked that you'd like to talk about?
Well, one of the things I need to talk about is that when you talk about Special Olympics, one of our own residents, Betsy Corey, placed in the Greater Games in Los Angeles, and she was a swimmer with St. Madeline Sophie's swim program, and she had a second place medal. And got to meet some Olympic swimmers who helped coach her. So
what a thrill for her.
She was amazing and just lovely and worked a little hard out to do that. So our folks are all over San Diego and all over the country. So we're very excited about what they can do and how they can be part of the community.
You know, thank you, Molly, for coming in. I can certainly see why you were chosen as one of the women in leadership in San Diego by the East County Chamber of Commerce. It's wonderful what you're doing. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. And I just appreciate you wanting to hear about NOAA Homes. And I hope anybody who hears us and has questions, please jump on our website and give me a call and let me know what you might be able to do to help us out and help our folks out to live wonderful lives. So thank you, Leon, for having me.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is Leon Thompson with an education report. No Child Left Behind Act was adopted in 2001 under President George W. Bush and perpetuated by the Obama administration. But after years of complaints from parents and students, President Barack Obama has announced new guidelines aimed at reducing mandatory testing. In a video posted on Facebook, the president announced that he's heard from parents concerned about too much testing and teachers who feel so much pressure to teach to a test that it takes the joy out of teaching and learning. The president said, "I want to fix that." The new guidelines call for no more than 2% of class time to be spent on test taking. School districts should utilize only tests that are worth taking, that are high in quality, aimed at assuring good instruction, and that students are on track. It is unclear whether Obama aims to roll back requirements that tie federal funding to completion of tests, such as Common Core standards. The president plans meetings this week with teachers as well as representatives from school districts and states to talk about the reforms. More details will be released in January, the White House has indicated. For now, the new guidelines are voluntary, though mandatory changes could take place if Congress votes to change the No Child Left Behind law to include the new recommendations. The actions come after the Council of Great City Schools issued a report which found that there is no correlation between mandated testing time and reading math scores on the National Assessment of Educational Progress. The average child in a big city school takes 112 mandatory standardized tests by the time he or she graduates from high school, the study found. Students spend 25 hours each year taking standardized tests and substantially more time on test preparation. The push for standardized testing had aimed to assure that schools are succeeding in helping students learn, particularly in disadvantaged communities. But critics contend that overemphasis on testing leaves little time for creativity in the classroom and a curriculum that includes subjects such as art and music. Obama's action quickly drew praise from educators. The National Education Association tweeted, "Parents, students, educators, the administration has heard your voices. Students need time to learn." Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, called the reforms common sense, noting that both the current and former secretaries of education also back reforms. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton also voiced support for the reforms that she said move us in the right direction. She adds that standardized tests should be high quality, fair, fully transparent to students and parents, and tied to improving learning.
180,000 California families with severely ill children are breathing a sigh of relief this week after Governor Jerry Brown signed Assembly Bill 187, which reauthorized the California Children's Services Program, or CCS. The children in CCS get treatment for things like cystic fibrosis, pediatric cancer, and other more rare severe illnesses. Kelly Hardy with the children's advocacy group Children Now says that patients are highly dependent on the program.
For these vulnerable kids and families, it's very complicated to navigate the healthcare system, and losing access to care or losing access to a certain specialist, even for a day or two, could be life-threatening.
CCS has been around since 1927. It is currently being considered as a model for a similar federal program. Kelly says CCS is being redesigned this year to make it easier on families.
Right now, CCS only covers the CCS-related conditions, and for other primary care, a child would go through regular Medi-Cal. We're very hopeful that a improved CCS system would provide whole child care.
The final redesign will be approved in 2016 and should be implemented by January 2017. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride, who never made it to the altar and died along the trail, reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life, Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill, and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region, between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery, and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the phantom stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The phantom stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The phantom stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the phantom stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reaching Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thief survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing their frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large, Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed, as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tail of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of three emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the three travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other two men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other two noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The two men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The two men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the three emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the third arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired two other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had 3 ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around. But he ordered the other two ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost a million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's Navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Cahuilla Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Cahuillas began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Cahuilla did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot-high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancerna, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it, perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie, otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long-dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with the fortune and pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day, when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s, when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hakumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hakumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hakumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994, when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wild cat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wild cats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brook, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub, which can have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night. Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. "I sure froze in my tracks," she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsong, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, A.K. Jules, and Turco Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.